Hi, folks. It's Michael Shilley here. Larry Tamblyn was in the Standells, really put the band together and has kept the band together. One of those guests that kind of didn't always answer the questions, which not, you know, it's not always my favorite kind of interview, but, you know, clearly his love for the Standells and for the music is clear, and I think you'll enjoy this interview. The sort of early 1960s L.A. scene is something that I can never get enough information about, and he tells some pretty funny stories here. So check out my interview here with Larry Tamblyn of the Standells. Yeah, there are the Standells. That really is just one of the greatest songs ever. I really believe it's true. Joining us on the telephone, Larry Tamblyn of the Standells. Welcome to WFMU and good morning to you.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be here.
You born in Los Angeles, I believe, and you're a teenager in the mid-1950s, just as rock and roll is sort of exploding. Did you know immediately that rock and roll was going to be your future?
I had a good indication of that, although all of my stepfather and my brother said it's a waste of time. I had that inclination.
So you had a sort of a career as a solo artist for a while. You put out some singles, and they're a little bit in sort of the pop idol vein in a way. And then sort of as the 60s came, you formed the Standells in the early 60s around 1962. Tell me, this is pre-Beatles. What is the L.A. club scene like in the early 1960s?
Well, it was, you know, before the early 1960s, it was mainly, you know, solo artists that were happening, and even groups like the Four Seasons, who I much admired. They made them into a doo-wop group. I mean, nobody ever played their own instruments back then, and if they did, they pulled them out from in front of their instruments and made them into something else. So, you know, it really wasn't until the Beatles happened that it became fashionable to actually be a group and play your own instruments.
Gotcha. So you had guys like Tommy Sands or whoever who would be backed by a band. So when you guys started the band, I mean, I get this, you know, this feeling of L.A. in the early 60s, you know, all these baby boomers are now in their teens and 20s and whatnot and ready to go out and party. And there was kind of this need for clubs and bands, and the Standells sort of formed in that spirit, I'm guessing.
Yeah. The clubs, you know, they needed self-contained groups, obviously. They couldn't afford a dozen people, you know, to perform. So to have a self-contained rock group that did their own singing and their own music was quite in demand. We were working all the time back there. I must tell you, you talked about my early days. I mean, I started recording when I was about 16, doing solo records for Eddie Davis Farrell Records. And I actually was an acquaintance of Richie Valens in the early days. We used to compete for, we had our own bands, kid bands, doing wedding parties and quinceañeras and things. And in the process, I met Richie a couple of times, and I was just completely blown away by his talent.
Hmm. Yeah, we had Chris Montez, who sort of said a similar thing. He was on the show, and he said he used to play on bills with Richie sometimes or see him and would just be blown away by the guy.
Yeah, Chris Montez was another one. It's really a neat experience. You know, I'd always been a follower of his, you know, since the early days. And he was out of that same vein, and is probably one of the early, you know, one of the early pioneers of Chicano rock. You know, and I was involved in that as well through Eddie Davis. I worked with a lot of early Chicano groups, you know, like the Premieres, you know, Los Lobos, people like that, who they were a special kind of a brand of early rock and roll. So they meant a lot to me, and certainly Ritchie Valens was the greatest. And I have a great story about Ritchie Valens. I don't know if you have time for it, but
sure, go ahead.
It's one of the funniest things. Now it's funny. It wasn't at the time. After his death, you know, I got the bright idea to go audition for his record company, Delphi. And so me and a couple of buddies from high school went over there, and they wouldn't have anything to do with us. You know, there's a bunch of kids showing up at the front door. And so what we did, here's a bunch of 16, 17-year-old kids. We set up in the men's restroom, and we started to play. This is the truth. And one of my old high school alumni just reminded me of this. And so we set up, and they finally had to listen to us because everybody was complaining that they couldn't use the restroom without being bombarded by rock and roll. And so they had us come to a recording studio, and I wrote an article about this. You can find it on Standell's Facebook page. It's called "The Death of Larry Tamblyn, Almost." Because what we did is, you know, we went and did this session, and then Bob Keane showed up later on to listen to what we did. The first song that we recorded was something written by me and sung by me. It was called "Rockin' at the Cemetery," which is the best choice of materials right after Ritchie Valens' death. And Keane listened to that, and he threw up the lyrics in the you know, he threw them up and walked out, and it was very disheartening to both he and us. And of course, you know, Delphi never went on to have another hit on that label. He did change labels, and he had some major acts under them, but never under Delphi.
Yeah, that's a welcome to show business. Great welcome to show business story. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Welcome to show. You never know who you're going to run into on the way up and the way down.
So it's the early 1960s, and Standells are forming. You guys play in Honolulu, of all places, get a gig in a club, and then you're back to L.A. and some personnel shifts, and you get signed to Linda Records, and your first releases come out on Linda, and then you get signed to Liberty. Was it easy to get a record deal at that time for a rock band?
Well, Linda Records was also owned by Eddie Davis, and you know, he's the one that really discovered me and put out the singles. So he's the one that introduced me to some of the other members that would eventually become the Standells. Now, we just they had a band called the Starlighters, and there was Tony Valentino and another guy, I can't think of his name right now. But anyway, they all kind of fell apart. And then there was the three of us. And so we formed a new band. And I came up with the name Standells, because we were doing a lot of standing around agents' office trying to get work. And that's how the name was, the natural Standells. And so when you say, you know, we had records on Eddie Davis, Linda, they were just early recording sessions that we did, you know, for Eddie, and he didn't even bother to release them until we had a big hit, of course, with some of their others, like Dirty Water. Then he really released them and promoted them.
Now, that's interesting. So how'd you get signed to Liberty then?
This again is a true story. The guy that discovered us became our manager. It was a great manager. His name was Bert Jacobs. And Bert came in to see us. We were playing in this club in Hollywood. It was called the Peppermint West. And it was kind of a franchise of the Peppermint Lounge in New York. But this place was really wild. It was owned by a fashion designer, Marusha, and Hungarian. She says, "I want this. I want you to do that. I want you to do twist tonight. Do twist." And she would speak like this. And, of course, we had to do what she said. So we were playing in this club. We were the house band there for about a year. In 1963, a lot of people don't know about this, but we discovered a photo of the Beatles in Europe and in a European magazine. We said, "This is really cool with the hair and everything. Let's do this." And so we started Beatlemania there. There's some places an article on that. But us were the Long Moths back in 63, and one of the teen magazines came out and did a spread on it. And we were doing a lot of Beatles songs, plus our own songs. I mean, they're all the same. Both the Beatles and us did Twist and Shout. We did that. And everybody claims that we were just a cover group. Well, so was everybody else back then. You know, the Beatles were a cover group. They did, you know, Money, That's All I Want. We did Money. We were playing in this club, and Bert Jacobs happened to be in there, and he came up to us and he said, we didn't know him. He says, "Hey, if I can get you signed to Liberty Records, would you sign me with me as a manager?" We said, "Sure." We didn't have a manager. So he gets us signed sight unseen with Liberty Records. And we found out the way he did it was Bert was a bookie. And he would take a lot of bets from people, including many of the big wigs at Liberty. And so that's how he got us in there. They were into some money, and that's how he got us signed and seen with Liberty Records. Uh-huh. And, of course, we made a couple of recordings for Liberty. The problem with Liberty and even BJ after that is we were just paired with the wrong producers. The guy they assigned us was Dick Glasser, and he took a really riled, raunchy song that I wrote called The Shake and turned it into I don't know how best to describe it but as a doo-wop polka. I mean, it's supposed to be really wild, and he had a clavinet solo in the damn thing. Can you imagine that?
Yes.
And it's real wild. It's kind of like a Joey D and the Starlighters shout, and they put doo-wop singers behind it and just ruined the song. And, you know, back in those days, there weren't too many George Martins around. And, you know, we had to basically do what the producer said. And so he ruined that song. And then we did another. We had just signed with Liberty. I mean, after we had just signed with Liberty, we had just signed with a growing nightclub at the time. They were kind of part of the Sunset Strip. They were down a little bit further on Santa Monica. And Trini Lopez had just left them, and he had recorded an album that was quite successful. And so they brought the Standells in as the house band.
So you recorded live at PJ's, right?
Yeah, and at that time, we had our drummer quit us like 2 weeks before we would do the album. That was Gary Walker. We had a change of personality. By then, we had Tony and me and Gary Walker and Gary Lane. And Gary Walker just quit us. And, he formed the Walker Brothers, and along with a couple of people that I knew over the years, John Moss and Eccles. I knew both those guys, and in fact, Scott Engels and I were in the DMLA together when I was 14, and John Moss was the first act. He and his sister Judy were the first act to go to Hawaii right before us. They left and we came on. Shows you how small the world is. And Gary didn't even know them at the time. He wasn't with. So he got a hold of these two guys. They formed the Walker Brothers. They moved to London and became a huge hit over there.
So Dick Dodd has just joined the band, and he ends up being a great find because he's a great drummer and great personality and a lead singer on some of the greatest hits. And kind of quickly, you get signed to Tower, which is a affiliate of Capitol Records. And now it's kind of the mid-60s, and things are really blowing up in the sort of post-Beatles world.
Actually, we signed with Ed Cobb's company, Greengrass Productions. They, in turn, signed us with Tower Records.
Gotcha. So Ed is the guy who ends up writing a lot of hits for you guys, a lot of your most well-known songs, and becomes your producer. Also, around this time, it's very interesting. I guess this is one of the perks of being an L.A.-based band. You end up being in the Munsters and in movies like Get Yourself a College Girl and Ride on Sunset Strip, and you're on Ben Casey and the Bing Crosby Show. That must have been fun.
Well, it was. In fact, I think if I'm looking back now, the first television show we did was probably was Bing Crosby. Now I'm not sure. We also on the Ben Casey. We were just a background group in that. But Bing Crosby, we actually acted in. But we played a fictional group called the Love Bugs, and that was neat. We had a lot of connections. Ed Cobb's company had an agent that had a lot of show business contacts that got us in on those. They were at the time looking for some group that could fill the void of the Beatles. Everybody wanted the Beatles back then, and I think the funny thing is that everybody thinks we had rather short hair when we did those shows. Well, we had long hair before that. We were forced to cut it off because none of the nightclubs would take us with the long hair. So we had to cut most of the long hair off. And they referred to us as a number of names which I'd never heard before. Frat rock. That's a new term that it got by me. And we were just doing ourselves. We were just a rock and roll group, And Ed did sign us, and he did write Dirty Water. It was completely unlike the original, what we ended up with. We took and arranged it, gave it a different feel altogether, wrote in the guitar riff, a lot of the lyrics in it, and much of the stuff that made it into what it is. And we didn't get any writer's credits for it, and not even arrangement credits. Ed's friend, Lincoln Mayorga, got the arrangement credits, and he never set foot inside the studio.
Yeah, I've heard that story. It's a weird studio, a weird story that Lincoln would get the credit for that. I mean, are you saying just point blank that you feel you deserve some of the writer's credit on Dirty Water?
Yeah, I really feel we do. Yes.
Because, clearly...
I really feel.
Clearly, Ed was a songwriter, right? There's A Storm A-Comin' and Why Pick on Me and Sometimes Good Guys Don't Wear a White. These are all songs that he's credited with, and they're good songs. Did he write all of those, or...?
Yeah, if you look at Wikipedia, we also make that claim that we should have gotten writer's credit on that, because we did. If you would have heard the song, he wrote a standard blues song that happened to be, about... about Boston and there he had the experience over there. Supposedly he was mugged but it was basically a 16 bars 32 bars blues song. It wasn't much about it, and we really made it into what it was
by providing the riffs into the song. Well, let me ask you this: if somebody uses that song for a car commercial these days, do you guys get royalties from the master side of it?
Yeah. Well, anytime they use that for movies, in fact, they just used it in a movie recently, last year, in which we got nice royalty checks from it. But yes, we do get royalties from that. However, we don't get royalties when it's played on broadcast. They're trying to change that.
Right.
But only the writers writer gets royalties for broadcast.
You were talking earlier about the band being sometimes labeled as a cover band, but as I listened to the band all week long this week, it kind of struck me that you were a band that played that you were a live band to start with, and you played several sets a night, and of course you've got to play covers to fill out several sets a night, and so kids can dance. And then there's some originals thrown in, and then there's some sort of pop songs, like songs that that writers, you know, like Ed would write just for you guys. And then there's kind of a natural garage sensibility to the band, like the riffs that you guys came up with. And then later in the band, it sort of gets a little bit psychedelic. And I sort of think, to me, all of those things are what are the Standells, whether it's covering, you know, a song very straightforwardly, or whether it's rearranging Dirty Water, or whether it's your originals. To me, all of those things are what make the Standells.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for mentioning that, because we do consider ourselves a rock band, not a cover band. You consider, you know, cover bands, you have to consider the Rolling Stones, because they worked in clubs. You know, the Beatles, U2 worked in clubs for years, and most of the stuff they did was cover songs, you know. But yeah, we did manage to get in original songs, and you know, it's just the way it was. Nowadays, the kids get together, they hardly know each other, and they get signed to a $1 million record deal, you know, and they've never performed together. And it just wasn't the case back then. I mean, we knew each other pretty well for years.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that the Standells have, you know, you started over 50 years ago making records. It's a long time. I was reading an interview on the web, you know, preparing for this, where somebody was asking you about specific songs, and a bunch of them you said, you know, I really can't remember a thing about it. You know, it's a long time ago, and it's amazing that there's still a Standells. One other thing I saw was that you were on a gig with the Rolling Stones, and the admission was $5, and I was trying to think, well, how much money could the Standells have been paid to play on bills with bands like the Stones?
Well, you know, we made good money, but, you know, it's certainly not the money they get now. It's just like, you know, let's face it, you know, that was 46, 47 years ago. And, yeah, the admissions were great, but they got, were low, but they got huge crowds, and, you know, they filled stadiums, and, so that money all went to something, and you know, the Stones got most of it, and the rest of us got, you know, you know a little bit less. But there was we were on a tour with them, actually. It wasn't just one show. We were on about a month and a half long tour that took us all the way across the United States.
Is that as much fun as it sounds to do that?
It was fun, but it was crazy too. You know, the Stones back then, I mean, they were kind of mystique to us, you know. Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, and Brian Jones, they kind of stuck to themselves. They didn't socialize very much. I knew much better. I knew Charlie Watts and Bill Wyman. But the three of those guys, they just, you know, they were just kind of weird. and I mean, those guys, I got to tell you, I am surprised that with the exception of Brian Jones, that they're living today. I mean, they were doing so much drugs back then. I mean, these guys were into everything. That plane we were on could have flown without the engines. We were on one flight, as a matter of fact, in the this is the truth. The pressure window on it. Everybody was stoned in there, except me. I didn't do drugs back then. But everybody was stoned, and the pressure window on the plane split, and so it lost pressure. The plane had to go into a steep dive to get down to where it would be the proper air pressure for us. And you never saw a bunch of stone guys sober up so fast in your life. But it was quite amazing. We had plenty of adventures on that tour. I can remember, you know, playing at Lynn Stadium in Boston, and the huge crowds there, and we were right in the middle of it, and the Stones started playing Satisfaction, and all of the crowds rushed toward the stage, and the security there shot off tear gas. And they had to cut the show short, and it literally was a riot. The only way that we could get out of the stadium was to get in our bus that brought us there from the airport, and we had to drive through clouds of tear gas to get out. And I want to tell you, man, that was a tearful experience.
That's amazing. So the band goes on with a few personnel changes, and you know, by the late '60s, it just seems like the Standells are over pretty much. Did you guys? Was it a conscious thing, or what happened exactly?
Well, it's you know the way a lot of groups go. They have you know different ideas of what they want to do. Dick always made it pretty clear he wanted to be a solo performer. He quit the group. Even while it was popular, he quit. He quit the group right after we made Dirty Water, as a matter of fact, and went with some group. And he couldn't stand a couple of the members in the group, not me, but couldn't stand a couple of the others. And so he left the group. We brought in Dewey Martin. This was in I want to say early '65.
From Buffalo and, Springfield, right?
Yeah, and Dewey Martin. I love Dewey Martin. And so Dewey actually performed with us for a while, for a few months. And then during this time is when Dirty Water started climbing the charts. I mean, it started off in a small station in Orlando, of all places, WLOF, and went on to be number one there and then went into Miami and spread on up the coast until it was a big hit. But during this time, we were playing clubs in California, and we were up in San Jose playing in this biker bar up there, and that was quite a kick. And but you know, we heard from Dick Dodd that he wanted to rejoin the group again because it was suddenly the record was getting played, and I didn't want him back because I didn't want the trouble. And but the other guys wanted him back, so we had to fire Dewey and bring Dick back into it. So he quit back then, you know, and then he quit the group back again, and I became friends with Dick. You know, I just didn't think he was dependable, but I became friends with him, and he quit the group again in 1968, and it was just it was a time that we were just starting to go down a little bit. We hadn't had a hit record. I mean, our last attempt, as you know, was Try It. And that, according to everybody, was headed toward the top of the charts until this moral majority idiot out of Texas, Gordon McClendon, decided to start a campaign in obscenity and record lyrics, and he deemed our song to be the worst of the bunch, and the lyrics to write and such to Try It were, you know, by the way you look, I could tell that you want some action. Action is my middle name. Come over here, pretty girl. I'll give you satisfaction. The two are needed for this game. I'll give you sweet love you've never had before. I mean, that's about the extent of what the lyrics were. And he was pinning this as being obscene. It was encouraging young girls to have sex. Now, Art Linkletter heard about this, and he has, did you hear about this? He has, on his show, debating McClendon. He had at that time he had Art Linkletter's house party, but he had a small segment called Let's Talk, where different factions would debate each other. And he had us on there debating McClendon, and we killed him. We absolutely killed him. And it was mostly funny stuff that they edited out, by the way. They wanted to make it look more even-handed. But can you imagine this idiot, you know, dressed in a suit and talking about obscenity and record lyrics? And here the Stones had Let's Spend the Night Together out at the time. And he was picking on the Standells because we weren't as big as the Stones. And so we, you know, we would come up with the, you know, what about some of the lyrics of songs of your days? Like birds do it, bees do it. What are they talking about? You know, he couldn't answer that. And so we massacred him. And he ruined the record. It was number one in a lot of markets. A lot of them stopped playing it because ECD had a national campaign that he just told people not to play it. And he was very powerful, the owner of radio station KLIF in Dallas, and a programmer of a lot of stations across the country. They just stopped playing it. And so it was really a major disappointment to us because we thought it was going to be a hit.
So it's
that was kind of the downfall of the Standells.
Mm. So in the Standells, many reunions over the years, and it seems to be sort of a little bit more of a permanent thing now, and you guys regularly tour and getting some real good reactions and around the world. It's funny, as the years go by, the different generations sort of catch on and the legacy kind of grows. That must be fun for you. But in the intervening years, what did you do to, did you still play music or did you get a Squaresville job? What'd you do?
Me, myself, I was so sick of the whole thing and having to depend on other people that just didn't seem to give a damn about things, and including Dick. He quit again in 68 and went on a solo career, which went nowhere. And I just thought, I'm not going to have my livelihood depending on this kind of stuff. So I went into, I was a recording engineer, and actually studied under Richie Podler and Bill Cooper, who are engineers in a lot of our earlier recordings. And I did that for a while, and then I went into children's products. I was a producer of children's records. I worked for Mattel Toys for a while, developing children's products. And so I had a whole different life in that, And eventually, in the 80s, we had a call for a reunion. All the originals got back together, and we did some gigs. We did, a big concert at this hotel at Harrah's in Reno. We were there for a week, and it just ran into the same old thing again. People that you couldn't count on that were into other things and into drugs they weren't dependable. So that didn't last long. Then we had another reunion a little bit later in the 80s, and none of them seemed to work out. It was always the same kind of problem. I'm finally back in, I got to tell you, and a lot of people know this, Dick Dodd had a dependency problem. I loved him dearly, but he did have a dependency problem. I tried to, help him any way I could, but he always had a bunch of friends that he would run to that would encourage that behavior. And this is the way it went. And, every time we'd get together, it would be something that would stand in the way like that. So I think finally, we were called by the Red Sox. This was a highlight. In 2004. First of all, before that, we did K-Stomp in New York. We got together for that. That was a big thing. We put it in an album. Then we got right after that, we got called to do a tour. None of the guys wanted to go on the tour. It was a beautiful tour to Spain. None of them liked traveling, and none of them wanted to go. And so we had to cancel that. And so after that, we got called by the Red Sox for the 2004 World Series to come over and perform. And that was quite exciting. I got flights to call the day before they wanted us to come. And said, hey, would you guys like to come over and play for the World Series? Who gets a call like that?
Yeah.
So they had us over. We actually performed before the 50,000 crowd, and we were just huge stars over there. That's great.
Yeah, your song is basically the national anthem in Boston. Yeah, Dirty Water.
Well, it's their unofficial. They call it the unofficial winning anthem. Now, whatever that means, but they play it every time they win at home. And we've been to the Red Sox games to almost every World Series since 2004. They brought us back in 2005 for the home opener against the Yanks. Every time we went, they won. And then they brought us back for the ACLS championships in 2007. And then they just brought the Standells back recently in 2013 for the World Series. And yeah, we didn't perform this time. We just sat up in the stands. But it was really exciting. We were there when they won the World Series.
That's amazing.
And,
yeah.
we're just kind of the good luck charms for them, and they always seem to call us when they need us. But, you know, during this time, I think, you know, it was in 2009, and we had another tour lined up. I really wanted to do this full time, and none of the other guys wanted a tour. They wanted the Red Sox things and the things you go out and you do, and you get your money and come back and go about your business. But I wanted more, and I sat down, talked with all of them, and I said, here's what I want to do. I want to retire from working. I wanted to spend my time, you know, half the year just touring and having, you know, and living out my life and enjoying myself. And they all agreed. They said, that's great. You know, and so we put together another tour, an East Coast tour, right after that. We did a big show in Las Vegas in 2004. They contacted us for that. And I got to tell you, I was really, it was probably one of the worst performances the Standells ever did. I couldn't get those guys to rehearse. And they could care less. They were getting great money, and they're playing at the Cannery in Las Vegas. But I had talked to them before that, and I said, this is what I want to do. I want a tour. I really want to make that happen with the Standells. They all agreed, but yet none of them wanted to do anything. And finally, we put together a tour, another tour in New York and the East Coast and in Canada, and all of them backed out. So I said, you know, it sounds to me like you guys really don't want to be part of the group anymore. That's what it sounds like. And, you know, you want the gravy, but you don't want the other stuff. You don't want to get out on the road and do the good things. And they said, yeah, that's kind of it. And Tony said, you know, I got this other group that I joined, and I'm really more interested in them.
All right.
And they were called the Icons.
Larry, we gotta wrap this up a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Gap on.
That's okay. I think I get the picture. The website is standells-official.com, and Larry Tamblyn has been speaking with us. I'll tell you what I've got queued up here to get us out of here is the song "Ride on Sunset Strip." Well, tell me about this song.
Well, "Ride on Sunset Strip" was written by our current member John Fleck, who came back into the group later on. And John's an outstanding performer. He wrote a lot of the early Standell stuff too. He wrote it along with Tony Valentino, but John did most of the writing. They wrote it in 45 minutes, and it's just an outstanding song.
Wow, 45 minutes. That's amazing. Are you guys, is there any Standells gigs coming up? I think I saw one on your website, the Tiki Oasis in San Diego in August. Is that right?
Yeah, we just finished the national U.S. tour coast to coast, you know, last month. And then we just did a big concert in Italy at Parma. In Italy, it's a big, it's called Festival Beat. We just got back from that, and then next month we're going to be headlining at the Tiki Oasis in San Diego. That's on August 17th.
All right, and friends
we're keeping very busy these days.
Good. Friends can check out standells-official.com for information. Larry, thanks for joining us. It's what a fun story and an interesting story.
Oh, thanks. I'm sorry I gabbed on too much.
That's okay.
You can also find us on Facebook. We have a great Facebook page, and we're constantly updating on that.
Yeah, you're always posting cool old scrapbook stuff, and yeah, I recommend the Facebook page. All right, here is "Ride on the Sunset Strip." Larry Tamblyn, thanks so much.
You're welcome. Nice talking with you, Mike.
I'm going down to the strip tonight. I'm not on a stay-home trip tonight. Long hair seems to be the main attraction, but the heat is causing all the action. Bright lights everywhere, pretty girls with long, long hair. But somehow the people, they don't care. Just doesn't seem fair to buggy 'cause you got long hair. Even the parents are beginning. doesn't seem fair. You're buggy 'cause you got long hair. Even the parents are.